You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Today is Pearl Harbor Day, Monday, December 7th. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the poet Charles Harper Webb, author of the new book Shadow Ball, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. Charles Harper Webb is the author of numerous poetry collections, including Reading the Water, Tulip Farms and Leper Colonies, Hot Popsicles, and Amplified Dog. His poems have appeared in many journals and anthologies, including American Poetry Review, Paris Review, Iowa Review, Plowshares, Michigan Quarterly Review, Poets of the New Century, Best American Poetry, and the Pushcart Prize. Webb has received the Samuel French Morse Poetry Prize, the Kate Tufts Discovery Award, the Felix Pollack Prize, the Benjamin Saltman Prize, a Whiting Writers Award, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. He is professor of English at California State University, Long Beach, and directs the MFA in Writing program there. He was a faculty member of the Postgraduate Writing Conference at the Vermont College of Fine Arts in August 2009. I interviewed Charles Harper Webb in November by phone. I began by asking him to talk about how he became a writer.
Well, I never would have imagined that I would be a writer until probably well into my college years. I thought that I was going to be some sort of a physicist. I probably should have known I shouldn't, because it's hard for me to say the word physicist. But I did start off college with that in mind. I've always been real interested in science, but I've been a reader since I was a very little boy. My mother was a librarian, and I realize now that all through those years I was really developing the skills that would make me a writer, and I always liked reading so much. Well, actually, my first poems were little rhymed, dirty ditties, which I wrote to amuse my friends in high school.
That sounds like Roald Dahl or something.
Well, I discovered that I had that talent, that I could rhyme easily and quickly, and I had a very dirty mind, and put those things together, and I could make my friends laugh. I would even, don't do this to me now, but I would even take challenges where they'd say, write a poem on this subject, and it would always be something obscene, using these words, and I would write one, and that was a little parlor trick that I did.
Wow.
The things I wrote were, I'm sure, just awful, but, the fact that I was doing it at all amazed my friends, and so I did that, and then I began to write a few kind of emotional things. I had a friend when I was a senior in high school who wrote poetry, and I began to think, well, that might be a cool thing to do, but I just did a couple, and then I wrote some love poems to various girls, and those got me somewhere, that also was well received. So I began getting some positive reinforcement then, and about the time I was a junior in college, I realized I was playing in a rock and roll band, and I was writing, and I was way more interested in both of those things than I was in being a physicist.
Right.
And so I changed to an English major. I decided to do something frivolous with my life, and the rest is history.
Well, I would say that your experience studying science helped your poetry in any case, because some of these poems are definitely drawing on the sciences.
I'm still really interested in it, just not as interested as I am in writing.
Your new book, Shadow Ball, includes both new and selected poems. How did you come to put this compilation together?
Well, I am proud to say that Ed Ochester, who edits the Pitt Poetry Series, suggested it. We had been talking about doing a book together for a while, and things had never quite fallen into place, and he finally said, why don't you just do this? And so I did. And, I stopped sending anything else out anywhere and just waited to hear, because I've always wanted to be with Pitt. I really admire their poetry series, and many of my favorite poets are in the series. And so I just waited, and sure enough, I got the much anticipated phone call. They said they were going to do it.
That's great. It's a beautiful book. The cover is just, I mean, it's just gorgeous. It looks a little like a science fiction novel.
Yeah. I was amazed. I mean, I could tell you a weird little story about the cover if you want to hear.
Absolutely.
Because the title poem, Shadow Ball, is actually about the Negro Leagues mm-hmm. and baseball, I didn't think that would probably, you know, the baseball would be the bestseller for poetry audiences, so I didn't think the cover with baseball on it would be too good. And then I was trying to think, they asked me for ideas, and I'm bad at those, and I was trying to think of other things, and I never got anything very good, and I don't think the press liked anything either too much, and they were going to come up with something on their own, when I literally had a dream in which I saw kind of the earth in shadow, and I woke up and said, maybe that's Shadow Ball. And so I wrote a little email to the person who's working on the art and said, this may be a stupid idea, but how about Earth in Shadow or something? And boy, within, you know, the day, she had sent me back this wonderful cover. Let me credit Ann Walston, who is the cover designer. I mean, because she just took that little weird snippet of an idea and just made something really, really stunning out of it.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So I'm wondering if maybe you could read one of your poems for us.
Sure.
I was going to ask you to start with the poem titled Vikings.
Okay. This is a fun one to do because it's in four-beat lines. Vikings overran my boyhood dreams. Fierce blonde beards, slab chests, biceps gripped by bronze bands, dragon ships which terrorized my ancestors, weak Britons who whined to Christ, no match for Odin and the hard hammer of Thor. While other kids clutched toy guns and grenades, I swung my plastic war axe, immune to bullets, refusing to die. While they dreamed of rocketing through sunny skies, I dreamed of fjords, their crags and storms matching my dark moods, my doubts of God, my rages and my ecstasies. I snuck in twice to see the Norsemen, wincing but bearing it as the Saxon king chopped off Prince Gunnar's right hand. I gloried in the sulking gods and ravens and great trees, roots reaching underground to realms of dwarfs and trolls. I gloried in the runes on shields, the long oar strokes that sliced through ocean cold as steel. I gloried in the Valkyries bearing slain heroes to the mead halls of Valhalla to feast and fight and fondle blonde beauties forever, while we sad Methodists plucked harps and fluttered. Sissies, mommy had to dress for Sunday school. The day before Christmas vacation, when Danny Flynn called me a fish-lipped fool, I grabbed a trash can lid and slammed it like a war shield in his face. Then, while teachers shrilled their whistles and Mr. Bean, the porky principal, scurried for his axe, I leapt over Danny's blood and bawling, thrust my sword hand in my shirt, and stalked out into the cruel winter of third grade.
Thank you very much. That's wonderful. I'm glad you said that the structure is four-beat lines. It's really fun to realize that.
Yeah, so it's a sort of a tribute to Beowulf and that sort of thing. I mean, I don't do the Anglo-Saxon alliteration too much, but I just wanted that heavy beat of the kind of Germanic sagas.
Right, and you can sort of hear the oar strokes in that beat as well.
That's great. That's what I hope.
It seems to reflect the subject matter well. I also just picked up, as you read it this time, I hadn't picked up on it before, Mr. Bean, the porky principal, pork and beans. I love that.
Oh, all kinds of little jokes in my stuff.
I see one of the strengths of this poem being its ability to just bring back to me as a reader the special intensity of childhood feelings, you know, the absolute Viking injustices that faced us.
Yeah. Well, they had such good costumes, too.
They did, they did. Now, I'm curious, I know you have a child. Did having a child bring back memories that changed your poetry at all?
You know, I wrote that poem before he was born, but yes, they do. That, I mean, you know, it's a very good question, and they certainly do. I think having my son has changed my poetry a lot, not just from bringing back memories, but from kind of assuming the parental role with the responsibility and the love and tenderness and all of that that goes with it.
He's actually, I don't know how literally to take the subject matter of your poetry, but in the poem Sneaker Males, I thought I saw him. Was that?
Yeah, he's there.
He's in there.
Yeah,
so, And that poem, actually, I wonder if you'll know what I mean if I say that poem, Sneaker Males, seems to portray this same young man from Vikings, but at a different point in his life.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. He wasn't able to grow up to be the Viking that he hoped to be.
So I wonder if you could read Sneaker Males.
Sure. Sneaker Males. Big Bo, the beetle, digs a burrow under a prime heap of howler monkey dung, fills it with females, then guards the threshold, brandishing a horn as big as he is. Yet nub-nosed Sylvester tunnels into Bo's estate and mounts Bo's females as his enormosity does the oblivious dance called I'm the One. So genes of sneaker males survive. Tone-deaf canaries, deer with pygmy racks, cuttlefish so low on male mystique they wear drab female hues, mixed with the big guns girls, then when his studliness turns his rainbow pulsing back, dart in to sneak some female a packet of sperm. So every man is not 6'9" with a brick chin. My 3'6" son, watching SmackDown on TV, flexes and struts, then body slams the teddy bear Grandma sent for cuddling. You want a piece of me? He shrills and leaps on Kid Bear while I cringe. How long until Kid Bear is me? If only God had made me heavyweight champ as I used to pray. Still, tall Mike Ball, who dragged me through Taft Junior High's halls in my jock strap, got shot to death robbing a liquor store. Dallas Brandt, Walter Pye's all-star tailback, sports a frog belly and runs a laundromat, while I boast an alpha job, A-list wife, and all-star son because years back, like Sergeant Wimpley of the Yukon, I failed to get my man. He played guitar, had long blonde hair and connections, my girlfriend gushed, to Aerosmith. Just a friend, she claimed. But when her roommate said she's at the library, then stumbled over studying, I slipped my Boy Scout hatchet in my belt and went hunting. Back in high school, I'd played astrologist, the better to trade horoscopes with Cindy P, while Detective Daddy grilled me from the den. Helping Marty N with algebra, I encouraged her to whine about football-heavy Blake B and felt her breasts when X would not be found. That night, though, I prowled the stacks like Bo, who's heard suspicious scuffling and horn buffed and ready, comes. Rage and pain had swollen me to alpha size when, sure I saw them, I yanked my hatchet out. But the couple kissing in the dust of British lit were startled strangers. Nor did I find the traitors in the parking lot, though I peered in every car window before I drove home sobbing, threw myself in bed, and woke next morning in the small, familiar body I wear now.
Thanks very much. I, you know, I was not familiar with the meaning of a sneaker male until I read this poem, and then I looked it up. How did you come upon the term? And I'm wondering Go ahead.
No, I read it somewhere, too. I read it, you know, I wasn't familiar with it before I decided to write the poem. I just thought, what a cool name, what a weird name.
Yeah.
Because, of course, I pictured a male wearing sneakers. And then when I found out what it really was, I just thought, oh, this is too. I've got to do something with this.
That's right. So we should say what it really is, which I'm going to let you describe it.
Okay. Well, in the poem, it alludes to it. A sneaker male is a less than A-list male, a smaller, weaker male who manages to pass his genes along because he kind of waits in the wings, and when the big guys aren't looking, runs in and mates with the female. Like among chimpanzees, there's a big studly male who's supposed to have all of the females, but these other males kind of wait, and when the big male is occupied somewhere else, they run in, quickly mate with the females, and run away before they get pounded.
That was a fun thing to put in a poem, definitely. This is a general question about your writing. What would you say most changes in your poems between first and final draft? Do you see any sort of pattern or consistency to that?
Yeah, well, I think I do. In fact, I think that what changes is that I find out as I'm writing what it is I'm really writing about. In my best poems, I don't really know. It becomes a discovery. I just know, like with Sneaker Males, I knew that it was a funny name. The concept of it struck me as humorous and also sad, and you know, I could relate to it because I'm not 6'9" with a brick chin, and you know, so I just said, okay, I'm going to explore that, and then I do explore it. And if the poem is going to work, as the drafts accumulate, I see more and more what it's really about, and then, yeah, if it works, great, I've succeeded with that. And if I don't ever find out what it's really about, or it turns out to be about something not very interesting, then the poem goes in the later file or something. I don't throw it away, but I don't use it.
Yeah. Do you borrow from those old files to build new poems?
Well, I always say that I will, and maybe I will sometime, but I generally don't. I tend to have enough ideas that I can keep moving forward, but it makes me feel better not to just throw them away.
It's like a little security file.
Exactly.
Well, one of my favorite poems in this book is The Death of Santa Claus, and I wonder if you could read that one.
Sure. Yeah, it's good for Christmas coming up, huh?
Yeah, good or
okay.
Not good, but I love the poem.
Yeah. The Death of Santa Claus. He's had chest pains for weeks, but doctors don't make house calls to the North Pole. He's let his blue cross lapse. Blood tests make him faint. Hospital gowns always flap open. Waiting rooms upset his stomach, and it's only indigestion anyway, he thinks. Until feeding the reindeer, he feels as if a monster fist has grabbed his heart and won't stop squeezing. He can't breathe, and the beautiful white world he loves goes black. And he drops on his jelly belly in the snow, and Mrs. Claus tears out of the toy factory wailing, and the elves wring their little hands, and Rudolph's nose blinks like a sad ambulance light. And in a tract house in Houston, Texas, I'm 8, telling my mom that stupid kids at school say Santa's a big fake. And she sits with me on our purple-flowered couch and takes my hand, tears in her throat, the terrible news rising in her eyes.
Thank you so much. I love that poem. I'm curious, when you wrote that, did you know all along where you were going?
No, that's a good example of what I was just saying.
Yeah.
I just had this idea. I tend to think in kind of cartoons and comic figures, and I had the idea that it would be kind of a funny little gag to really imagine Santa having a heart attack. Now, that may say something about my sense of humor, but it sort of started with that, like he was a cartoon Santa having a heart attack. I mean, Santa isn't supposed to have heart attacks. He's not supposed to die. And so I just started with that. But again, I knew somewhere in my head that it was more important than that. That's what makes me start to write. And so as I wrote it, I could just begin to see more and more what it was really about. Yeah, I always had carried in my mind the memory of my mother telling me, and I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it because I believed my parents. They'd assured me Santa was real, and I believed them implicitly. Right. So all kinds of things come together there. And I didn't know they were there, but I unconsciously sensed that there was something there.
Yeah. And the point at which this poem changes is just mid-sentence between all of the things that are happening to him. He drops on his jelly belly, and Mrs. Claus, you know, tears out, and Rudolph's nose blinks, and in a tract house. You know, I loved how that was just part of the whole universe. You know, it just continued on, and suddenly we're in Houston. Now, there's a darkly comic sense to this poem and a lot of your poems. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, that just seems to be part of my consciousness. I guess I see the world that way. I often get pegged as a funny poet, and I always think when somebody says that, well, I mean, especially if they say it in a dismissive way, I think, well, yeah, I guess they're funny. There's funny things in them. But to me, humor generally overlies something really serious and often really sad. I'm certainly not the first person to say that.
Sure.
But for me, it's true. So I have always seen the world in a humorous way, and I've always seen the world as sad.
And I think, too, in your poems, I noticed sort of a larger sense of the mythology that we grow up with and how it ties into the reality that we live. Do you know what I mean?
So, yeah.
So there's the death of Santa Claus, and there's how Vikings translate into the world of a child in contemporary society. And then there's, you also have a poem about Superman, where he's actually going through some fairly mortal challenges, and I liked recognizing that was there in some of your poems.
I wish everybody noticed that because they want to kind of put me sometimes in the kind of Jerry Lewis school of poetry, like it's all gags and stuff, and it isn't.
No, I don't think so. Now, the death of Santa Claus came from a book called Reading the Water, which won the 1997 Morse Poetry Prize. And another poem that I enjoyed from that collection is Spiders. And I loved that you treated spiders with awe, and you classify them as beautiful in this poem, which I also agree with. Can you maybe read that one?
Sure. I'll warn the listeners, it takes a while to get to the beautiful part.
Oh, yeah, and I probably shouldn't have put the spoiler in, should I?
No, that's okay. They're animals that create many different emotions.
Yes.
Spiders. They drift through darkness, eight-fingered hands grasping for your eyes. In daylight, they occur like accidents, suddenly there. They are fear's footprint on the shower floor, its rune stamped on the wall. Small, hopping nightmares, scuttling aliens, they charge at you with scrabbly legs, jaws dripping pain. Masters of treachery, they leap from hiding, paralyze their prey, then suck it dry. Creeping out from dusty corners, cracks in walls, they are your landlords when the lights die. Fuzzy succubi, they sleep with you, leave itchy kisses where they've been. Walking to the bathroom, 2 a.m., your feet tickle. Don't hit the light switch. Don't look down. It's not enough to spray them with black flag. They must be drowned in it. It's not enough to crush one gently, grind it underfoot until it disappears. Yet, they are beautiful. Furry as buffalo, long-limbed as ballerinas. Tiny illusionists, they rise and fall on invisible sky wires. Millions of years after crawling from the sea, they throw out nets to harvest the breeze. They weave blankets for the ground's feet, shawls for the quivering shoulders of the trees. Their webs, transparent fielder's gloves, pluck flies out of midair. In this world they helped create, I am the newcomer, threatening get out of town by dawn. Yet, elfin bodyguards, they clear a path for me through the constant crush of bugs. They cordon off a spot, my private tuffet, and they run away when I sit down.
Thank you. I loved my private tuffet. We never get to say tuffet in normal life.
No. I hope people still do the Little Miss Muffet thing. Otherwise, they won't know what that is.
Oh, I think they will. I think Little Miss Muffet is still there.
Good.
I'm curious, do you find every creature beautiful or not necessarily?
Well, I guess I'd have to think about that. I certainly find every creature fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the biologist in me. I just think they're astonishing. But, yeah, I mean, even we have a picture right now on my turtle calendar of an alligator snapper, and my boy looked at it and said, "Ah, he's ugly." And I had to admit, yeah, he's pretty ugly, but they're pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'd say I probably do find them all beautiful in some way. I mean, maybe I draw the line at tapeworms and various parasites. I mean, I don't know if I can extend my humanity out that far.
Well, I liked listening to you read spiders because you had a sort of Boris Karloffian thing that came into your voice at a certain point. It was very fun.
Yeah, well, you know, I really am afraid of them. And I'm a lot better now, but we have so many black widows around here, I have to kill them all the time because I got really nervous about them when my son was just a toddler.
Right.
And so I've seen so many of them now, I've handled them so much or dealt with them that I'm not nearly as afraid of them as I used to be.
I'm going to ask you to read another poem that's also fun. I don't think this one's as dark. My wife insists that on our first date I told her I had 7 kinds of hair. That's a great title to start with.
Yeah, that was not as dark. That was celebratory. My wife insists that on our first date I told her I had 7 kinds of hair. Straight, frizzy, chest, nose, pubic. What was I thinking? 7 is special, I know. 7 thieves, 7 wonders, sleepers, worthies, gables, cities, 7th sons of 7th sons with more mojo than 7 men. We ate at Mogo's, I remember, where we chose from a dozen kinds of vegetables, as well as chicken, turkey, pork, and beef. The chef spilled our choices onto a grill, then moved from pile to sizzling pile, chopped, smoothed, arranged, until, with his skilled spatula, he heaped hot meals into the begging bowls we both thrust out. I led us to a dim corner, well aware that of the 3 body types, 6 kinds of laughs, 5 kinds of breasts, and 8 varieties of lips, hers held the summit at each heap. Her long, dark hair and sapphire eyes made my hands shake. Her shape unhinged my diaphragm. I'll bet I groped in my suddenly dim brain and spilled whatever I found onto our talk. I was so eager to keep it sizzling, so hungry to seem a man whose invention never failed, well endowed with all good things, including hair. At least one kind, I must have meant, is right for you.
I thought that was really fun. It seemed like you were having a good time with the numbers and the food and the whole atmosphere of the moment.
Yeah, I had no idea that was what was going to happen. But I think I actually did say something that idiotic because the woman who cut my hair had once told me I had 7 kinds of hair, but I had no idea what she meant.
Is this a certain form, or is it just filled with fun rhyme and rhythm?
You know, it's not a form, not a fixed form, but yeah, I tried to exploit, I don't know, the poetry of the sounds and the images and so forth. You know, a lot of people have said that a good free verse poem has to be in a lot of ways, you know, tighter and more tightly controlled than a fixed form poem, because you don't have the fixed form to keep you in line. So, yeah, I just played around with it to get something that I liked.
Yeah, one thing that I liked, which I don't know if this was in your mind or not, and it's probably a Japanese restaurant you're describing. Is that true?
Well, Mogos, out here, it's called Mongolian barbecue, and they call it Mogos. I don't know if that's their name or if it's something to do with Mongolian.
Oh, okay.
But it's like a Japanese thing. Yeah, that you are. They cook it in front of you and all.
So it's maybe not relevant at all, because this, I think, would be more Chinese, but when you said dim corner and dim brain, I was thinking dim sum.
Oh, well, I like that. I mean, it's Asian enough. Let's say I thought of it. No, it's good.
Yeah, no, it was fun to read. Really fun, that one. Now, we're on food poems and also sort of love poems of a sort, and I'm wondering if we can talk about another one called A Meal Not Eaten.
Sure. This one came about when I overheard a really odd sentence, and I'm always on the lookout for odd things that spark something in me, and this was the sentence, which is an epigraph in the poem. Somewhere there's an uneaten Chinese dinner with our name on it.
I love that.
I know. Isn't that weird? And so I wrote this poem called A Meal Not Eaten. The wonton soup drifts in warm fog just out of reach. Dragons circle the bowl as if to guard the one pink shrimp that bobs like a dead monster from the deep. Steam wisps off the twice-cooked pork and chopped bok choy. The emperor's chicken is here, too. Sliced peppers, red and green, black mushroom gongs, white meat glistening in glaze. We feed each other between kisses, screened by our red leather booth, ignoring vines that loop and dangle overhead, the waiters gliding back and forth, so unobtrusive, it's as if platters fly solo through the air. One floats toward us, bearing orange halves offered in their bowls of pebbled skin. Fortune cookies brittle purses and fold futures that, like this past, never occurred. I didn't pay the bill, open her door, or drive her to my house, where we never made love in this bed where I lie now, in which I can almost touch her, asleep beside me as my wife, though she is not, and hasn't been for a long time.
Thank you very much. When I read this poem, I thought, wow, you know, I bet the spouses of poets have to be really emotionally hardy.
Yeah, they do, and they aren't always. So poets have to be, I tell all my students this, they have to be somewhat careful about what they show to the spouses, because even if it's a complete fantasy or completely made up, it always seems like it isn't.
Yeah.
And sometimes it really isn't. It's difficult when you're dealing with the imagination, which is so untrammeled, and life, which is so trammeled by all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, every writer and his or her spouse or has got to come to some sort of grips with it, or they'll be fighting all the time.
Right. In this poem, the change of closeness from that sort of intimate, shared first person of we feed each other between kisses, and then that moves into a reflective sort of I didn't drive her to my house, and it goes on. You know, I loved that intimacy changed. all with that cracking of the fortune cookie. It seems like that's the moment on which it turns. So can you talk a little bit about that at all?
Only that's what happened as the poem unfolded. I just had this idea of a Chinese dinner that did not occur, but that was, you know, that was associated with a couple of people. And I just kind of wrote to see where it would go. And in the end, this sense of sadness, I guess, for unlived possibilities and how we never get to, we only have one life, and there's so many other lives we'd like to have. You know, not in any particular way, but just that emotion kind of came through there. Mm-hmm. And the poem happened. Again, it didn't just happen immediately. I work towards these things. Sometimes it comes out on the first draft, and sometimes it has to be discovered.
Yeah. It's really fun. You know, you go from present tense, you know, past event in the present tense, and then at the fortune cookie where we start talking about the future, you go into the past tense. It's just sort of fun to read.
Yeah, well, it's if I had to explain where all the tenses were, I don't think I could, because it just kind of, it's something that's instinctive, and dealing with the idea of dealing with something that didn't happen as if it did happen, and as if it was kind of always there.
Yeah.
It's like in an alternate universe or something. I just sort of stumbled through it, trying to find something that would make sense and that would not leave the reader scratching her head.
Well, you can still be scratching your head and smiling at the same time.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, Charles, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on more poems. I'm always working on those. I'm working on putting together a book of essays, too, that I've written through the years, generally for writers' conferences, craft things on poetry. I mean, they range all over the place, but I've got enough of them now. I'd like to see that in a book. So those are the main things.
What writers would you say have had influence on your, either on your work or personally?
Well, that is always a tough question, because I've read a lot, and so many have. I mean, early on, Charles Dickens and Mark Twain were really influential when I was a kid. And Byron, I always liked George Gordon, Lord Byron. I even named my son Eric Byron.
Mm-hmm.
Dostoevsky, Kafka were really important to me. And then, you know, the T.S. Eliot was important. I like Dylan Thomas. I remember I was knocked out the first time I ever heard Fern Hill, and I still am knocked out whenever I hear that poem.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some other ones might be people that taught me things. Edward Field, who is a poet who's still living, taught me how to use contemporary culture in my poems, and he taught me a lot just by reading a couple of his books. And you know, Russell Edson did the same. I realized that I was trying to write prose poems sometimes, and I didn't know what they were. And when I encountered Russell Edson, I thought, oh, my God, this is what I've been trying to do, and he's doing it so much better. So I learned from him in that way. Yeah, there's just a lot, but that's a few.
What are you reading right now?
Well, I always have to... I have to apologize for that, because I have long drives getting to and from my place of work. So a lot of my reading is books on tape, and some people find that, oh, good.
Oh, yeah.
I've been told that doesn't really count as reading,
but
I think it does. So I just finished Junot Diaz's novel, The Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, and that was pretty cool. I'd begun rereading The Magus by John Fowles.
Ooh, that's a wonderful book.
Yeah. It just blew me away when I first read it, which was when I was back in grad school. And I have kind of read it since then, but not fully. I've sort of skimmed it for various reasons. I just sat down to start really rereading it. It is just as amazing, maybe more so to me now than it was when I first read it.
Yeah, it's such a wild storyline. At a certain point, you have to just abandon yourself to it and not try to understand everything that's happening.
Yeah, I remember it just drove me crazy as a graduate student. I mean, I was so engrossed in it and so involved, and it was like I felt like I was the lead character, that the 25-year-old male. I felt like I was him, and I was being just jerked around
right.
by the puppet strings.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, and then in the world of poetry, I was reading. I have been reading Reaching Out to the World by Robert Bly, a collection of his prose poems, which I've really been enjoying. And I just finished reading Usher by B.H. Fairchild, who is one of a friend and a favorite, and also Carpathia by Cecilia Wallach, who is also a friend and a favorite. So I just got Carpathia, and I have had Usher for a while. So those are recent poetry books I've been reading.
Great. Let me ask you to read something again, if I could. At first, because of the epigraph, I sort of misread the poem titled How to Live, and I thought it had to do specifically with the writing life. But it's for anyone.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could read How to Live.
Sure. This poem came about because I kept reading, not in more than one poet's work, the line, "I don't know how to live." And that intrigued me because, I mean, of course, I know what they mean on a philosophical level, but the kind of inveterate wise ass in me said, well, yeah, you just breathe. It's easy. And I thought, I'm gonna respond to this. And this was what I ended up doing.
Okay.
How to live. Eat lots of steak and salmon and Thai curry and mushu pork and fresh green beans and baked potatoes and fresh strawberries with vanilla ice cream. Kickbox 3 days a week. Stay strong and lean. Go fly fishing every chance you get with friends who'll teach you secrets of the stream. Play guitar in a rock band. Read Dostoevsky, Whitman, Kafka, Shakespeare, Twain. Collect Uncle Scrooge comics. See Peckinpah's Straw Dogs and anything Monty Python made. Love freely. Treat ex-partners as kindly as you can. Wish them as well as you are able. Snorkel with moray eels and yellow tangs. Watch spinner dolphins earn their name as your panga slam bams over glittering seas. Try not to lie. It sours the soul. But being a patsy sours it too. If you cause a car wreck and aren't hurt but someone is, apologize silently. Learn from your mistake. Walk gratefully away. Let your insurance handle it. Never drive drunk. Don't be a drunk or any kind of aholic. It's bad English and bad news. Don't berate yourself. If you lose a game or prize you've earned, remember the winners history forgets. Remember them if you do win. Enjoy success. Have kids if you want and can afford them, but don't make them your reason to be. Spare them that misery. Take them to the beach. Mail order sea monkeys once in your life. Give someone the full-on ass-kicking he or she has earned. Keep a box turtle in good health for 20 years. If you get sick, don't thrive on suffering. There's nothing noble about pain. Die, if you need to, the best way you can. You define best. Go to the church if it helps you. Grow tomatoes to put store-bought in perspective. Listen to Elvis and Bach. Unless you're tone-deaf, own Perlman's Meditation from Thais. Don't look for hidden meanings in a cardinal song. Don't think TV characters talk to you. That's crazy. Don't be too sane. Work hard, loaf easily. Have good friends and be good to them. Be immoderate in moderation. Spend little time anesthetized. Dive the Great Barrier Reef. Don't touch the coral. Watch for sea snakes. Smile for the camera. Don't say cheese.
Thank you very much. That's great. A few of the line breaks in this poem seem to offer lessons just through the surprise of where they lead. And specifically, I'm talking about right here, if you cause a car wreck and aren't hurt, but someone is, apologize silently. So there's a between the line and the next line, there's a change in the meaning. And then there's another one, if you get sick, don't thrive on suffering. So I wonder, can you just talk a little bit about what you think these surprises accomplish in the poem?
Well, I think that they can give you two different meanings, which the deconstructionists are all very big on anyway, that everything kind of contains its opposite and can be deconstructed. I mean, I'm not a deconstructionist, but it's sort of like that. When I say apologize, the first line, if you cause a car wreck and aren't hurt, but someone is, apologize, that's of course one thing you could do, but then the silently, which comes on the next line and the next stanza, and it comes as a surprise, mm-hmm. sort of turns that apology on its head. So you're not really going to come out with it aloud, because we live in this litigious society where the next thing you know, you've lost your house and family.
Right.
So
right.
So it kind of it plays with the meaning that way. And then if you get sick, don't thrive. That seems to be a cruel thing to say until you get to on suffering, and then you have a whole different meaning. And I enjoy exploiting those when I can. And because poems are in lines, sometimes one can do that.
Yeah. I also liked the line, listen to Elvis and Bach, unless. And then the next line actually goes on, and unless is the start of a new thought. But you feel mm-hmm. like you're going to be told, unless this, unless there's some uh-huh. situation where you shouldn't listen to Elvis and Bach. But it's fun. It makes you think, well, why wouldn't I?
Yeah, that's very intentional. I really work a lot on my line breaks, both for rhythmic reasons and dramatic reasons. And when you can't always, I mean, if you always get a double meaning with your line breaks, then it becomes predictable. But it's fun to do that every once in a while when you can.
And now, as you've read these poems, I haven't noticed that you particularly emphasize your line breaks in the spoken reading. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. There are some readers who really, really hammer those line breaks. I don't, but I try to read it as if it's just regular English. But the words on the ends of my lines tend to be strong words, and so they'll linger a little bit, and sometimes I'll emphasize them just barely. But for me, I like to hear an uninterrupted flow for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you read it, you definitely have a pause because you have to. I mean, when you read it silently, you have to as your eye shifts from the end of one line over to the next one. And that the last word on a line break tends to linger a little bit. And hopefully in my readings, that may be coming through in a subtler way, but I certainly don't, pause at the end of every one.
Well, I think that we're at my last question.
Okay.
And that is, what advice do you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward with a piece?
I think that sometimes it helps. This is what I do. If I get stuck, sometimes I will just take a whole new run at the project. I mean, put away what I've done before and just run at it again and see what happens there. There's so many different things that you can do if you find, and it depends on where you're stuck. Often people are stuck at the ending. If you don't know how to end the poem, I think what really helps is to see if you can figure out what the poem has been about all along. And to do that, I mean, I have a couple of things that I will do. Sometimes I'll just try to go with a brainstorming thing and write a number of different endings,
mm-hmm.
just to see what happens. Just to write a bunch of them without thinking about any of them very much, and just see what happens there. if I can't do that, sometimes what I will do is actually write a little prose summary of the poem and what it's talking about. I used to be embarrassed about that, but then I learned that William Butler Yeats used to often write his poems out as little essays and then make them the beautiful lyrics that they are. So I don't think that I'm not embarrassed to do that anymore, but I know that it helped me, because when I just try to figure out, why did I write this poem? This is what I ask students all the time when they're stuck. You know, out of all the millions of subjects you could have chosen, why did you choose this one? And if they can think about that until they get an answer, often the ending will become clear to them. If you're stuck earlier on in a poem, sometimes it's because you're trying to fight where the poem really wants to go. I mean, sometimes you're trying to force the poem in a way that you thought it would go when it doesn't want to go there.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes it turns out, at least for me, that it was just a false start, that you know, I thought there was more there than I was able to discover.
Okay.
You know, you might see a little ore on the ground and think, oh, there's a gold mine here, but it turns out that ore is all you got. So I just say, okay, next.
Well, that's great. That's good advice. All right, well, Charles, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Charles Harper Webb. Next week, tune in to hear a talk with Deborah Shapiro, editor of the local publication Edible Green Mountains. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group, and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. And by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business. Located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the week. Louise Penny will read from and autograph her newest Inspector Gamache mystery, The Brutal Telling, tonight at 7 at Phoenix Books and Cafe in Essex. The author Willa Miller discusses Everyday Dharma, 7 weeks to Finding the Buddha in You, tomorrow, December 8th, from 7 to 8 p.m. at Barnes & Noble in South Burlington. Leon Thompson shares his third book of humor, Not Too Awful Bad, A Storyteller's Guide to Vermont, Friday, December 11th, 4 to 6 p.m. at Better Planet Books, Toys and Hobbies in St. Albans. Local author Ron Warnick discusses the research that went into his biography, Mary Baker Eddy, Christian Healer, Saturday and Sunday, December 12th and 13th, 12:30 to 1:30 at the Christian Science Reading Room in Burlington. Former Write the Book guest Thea Lewis discusses her book Haunted Burlington on Saturday, December 12th at 4:30 at Phoenix Books in Essex. Registered dietitian and local food advocate Diane Imrie will be at Phoenix Books and Cafe in Essex on Saturday, December 12th from 2 to 4. She'll conduct a demonstration of recipes from her book, Cooking Close to Home, and will then be available to sign copies of the book. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Charles Harper Webb. Charles recently published this prompt and one or two others in a collection titled The Working Poet, published by Autumn House Press and edited by Scott Miner. Choose two subjects that interest you. The more different and apparently unrelated, the better. You may choose two stories, two processes, and the examples that Charles offers are making beer and lethal injections. A story and a process, whatever. The important thing is that both subjects be of real interest to you. Now write a poem in which you combine the two subjects, letting each intermingle with and illuminate the other. Ideally, you will have no idea how to interconnect the two until, it may seem like magic, they do. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. Upcoming episodes of the show are often announced in my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you were listening right before my show started up today, you had the chance to hear The Wildlife, the new Radiator program hosted by former Write the Book guest Laurel Nemi, who interviews scientists, law enforcement officials, and others about the latest in wildlife research and investigation. The Radiator is able to bring you shows like The Wildlife and Write the Book and The World of Music, thanks to community support and involvement. More information about how to support the station is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby brings you The World of Music at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington.